You're listening to SaberCast with Rob Meyer, your home for the deepest insights into baseball featuring guests from throughout the game. SaberCast is a production of the Society for American Baseball Research. For more information about Saber and to check out the show page, visit saber.org. Now, here's Rob Meyer.
Welcome to SaberCast. I am Rob Meyer, and boy, what a absolute delight it's been for me to speak to Eddie Frierson. For many of you, Eddie Frierson is Christy Mathewson. Since 1987, he has been portraying Mathewson in Frierson's one-man play, Matty, An Evening with Christy Mathewson. And I saw the play at the Sabre Convention 25 years ago, the summer of 1998 in San Francisco at the Sabre Convention. When I first thought, oh, you know, it'd be fun to talk to Eddie Frierson, and I've never met him, but he must have some good stories to tell. And with the long history now of the play, there's a lot to draw on there. I'm sure he's met lots of people and gone through different iterations of the play and talk about the creative process. I did wonder a little bit about my ability to come up with enough good questions for a 45-minute podcast episode. Well, guess what? Not a problem. In fact, we spoke for so long that for the very first time, this is a two-part episode, or you could say it's two episodes, one interview. So this is the first roughly half of our conversation. Next week, we'll be back with the second half. But just in this bit, Eddie and I talk about his experience as a Braves fan in the early 70s, his ambition in high school to be the next Vin Scully and play Major League Baseball and be a professional actor. He didn't quite accomplish all of those, but gosh, pretty close, really. His time pitching at UCLA, the original conception for the play, Matty, his deep dive into Christy Mathewson's life and career. We took a detour into Eddie's voiceover work in animation and I guess some commercials as well. He has been, I didn't know this until an hour before we spoke, he's been in many dozens of animated productions, both movies and television, including many, many well-known movies, and I couldn't help asking him about that. I also did not realize that he was instrumental in the making of the movie Moneyball. So I really enjoyed that part of our conversation. And again, just getting started. There's much more to come in our next episode. Later, I will be back with a note about what I have been reading. I'm sure I'll have some random thought about what's been happening in Major League Baseball. Might be upset related. We will see. But first, here is the first nearly an hour of my conversation with the delightful Eddie Frierson. Eddie, this is such a thrill for me. Welcome to SaberCast.
I'm just tickled to death to be here.
I will admit something to you. When I first thought about asking you to come on the show, I immediately thought it was a good idea, even before I actually asked. But I will also say I had a small bit of trepidation because I thought to myself, am I smart enough? Am I a good enough interviewer to talk to this person I've admired for a long time about this single thing that I know about him? I'm not sure I'm smart enough for that. And then I did some research. Holy cow, what a life you have led these last 45-ish years. It's an amazing thing. If I ran into you somewhere, I would happily spend an hour talking to you about everything besides Matty. So
yeah,
this is going to be...
Don't get me started on why I hate the wild card.
Yeah, we don't even need to talk about anything topical whatsoever. There's just so much. You've done so many things. You've been in some of my favorite movies. I mean, the list just goes on and on. So this is going, I'm going to guess this is going to be very easy for me. I don't know about you, but let's go back to the beginning or near the beginning, growing up. When did you become aware of baseball? Who was your favorite player when you were growing up? And then I want to talk a little bit about UCLA.
Well, those are pretty easy. I grew up in Nashville, Tennessee, so the only team that I could follow was the Atlanta Braves when they had the best lineup and the worst pitching in all of baseball. So, of course, Henry Aaron's my guy. Mm-hmm. I can remember Rico Carty and Ralph Garr and Felix Mion playing second base, and you had Torrey was on that team. As you know, it was like a whole slew of excellent veterans, but they just couldn't get over the hump. And then there was, you know, I was very small. Well, not small, but like third grade. I can remember the TVs coming into the room during that first playoff. Was it 69? Mm-hmm. When Henry Aaron homered in all three games, but they lost to the Miracle Mets. And then there was that story. But so Henry Aaron was my guy. So it was, you know, a thrill years later to have a kid that I coached at Santa Monica High sign with the Braves, and then I got a chance to chat with Henry a little
bit. Wow.
At the Cracker Jack Classic Old Timers game at RFK Stadium in 1987, mm-hmm. which was a thrill.
One of my very earliest memories of baseball, I don't think I've ever mentioned this. I think that we were visiting some friends of my parents, as I recall, this is a long time ago, and they had children, and we were outside playing one evening, and I have this distinct memory. It might be a false memory, but I have a distinct memory of being called in from playing to watch Henry Aaron hit his record-breaking home run. What do you remember about that?
Well, that was a special night. I remember I was down in the backyard, and a similar thing happened when Pete Rose was on his hit streak. Mm-hmm. They started preempting stuff when he came up to bat to see if it was going to extend. But everybody knew that it was just a matter of time before Henry hit it, and there was all the controversy because, you know, he didn't want to hit it in Cincinnati. And so they waited till they got home in Atlanta and all of that. So I can remember all of that going on at the same time. But that really was when I came to love the game. I mean, when I was a little kid, you know, tried out for the team. I think I was 10 years old and wasn't very good. I thought I was a left-handed hitter and wasn't. And then the next year made the team. And then, you know, you go on there and play American Legion ball and in high school and was fortunate to win a state championship in Tennessee with my Hillwood High School team. In fact, we just had a big reunion this past spring because it was the last year of the high school. They're tearing it down. They built a new one out at our rival site in Bellevue out there in Nashville. And so it was fun to see all those guys. And through that love of all of it, at the same time, I was doing theater in high school, had a wonderful teacher, Mr. Garris, Williams D. Garris, don't call me Bills. It just sort of came to love both things. There were three things I wanted to do in life. One was to be the next Vin Scully and be on the radio all the time, doing the play-by-play. Milo Hamilton was the guy I listened to growing up with the Braves. You know, there's a drive deep into left center field. Or I wanted to play in the big leagues. You know, that's everybody's dream if they like baseball at all. And then the last one was to be an actor. And I'm just fortunate enough that through acting, I've been able to do all three things, which is kind of fun.
Well, you at UCLA, I would assume you followed two of those paths because you were pitching. And right. I'm guessing you were acting at UCLA on some level as well. When you were playing, you couldn't have been broadcasting the games, obviously, but at what point did you decide I'm probably not going to be a broadcaster?
Well, but here's the thing. I actually broadcast my sister's basketball game. She was a national champion at UCLA, played with Annie Myers and, you know, tremendous team in the late 70s, and got to do that a lot, which was a ton of fun through the campus radio station and following
So you pursued all three paths.
It's
incredible.
And you know, what's really fun is a few years ago, and I think it's somewhere on my website, I knew the fellow who was broadcasting games for the Bakersfield Blaze, who they don't exist anymore, and he couldn't make a game one night and asked if I would fill in for him. And so I did, and it was just a ton of fun to, you know, have three and a half hours of just me out in Rancho Cucamonga in a beautiful facility for an A-ball team. It's the Angels farm team out there, and It was really fun. I even got them to reverse an official scoring thing. There's a pop-up on the infield, and the guy just missed the ball, and they called it a hit. Well, he didn't hit it. I said, well, that doesn't mean you can't call it an error. Yeah, and so they changed it to an error, which I guess made the parents of the player upset. But it's like, you know what? It's not gonna happen for him if he can't catch a pop-up.
One of the things that I don't think I knew, if I knew, I certainly forgot, was that you actually were a pitcher. I mean, I think when I saw your show, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, or I will talk about that, I just assumed, oh gosh, this is sweet. Great show. Love it. This is, of course, though, just an actor playing a pitcher. No, you were a pitcher playing a pitcher. And what was your... Can you talk a little bit about your time pitching, what your pitches were, maybe one of your favorite moments on the mound?
Sure. You know, the thing was I, you know, I came out to UCLA. You're a world killer in high school in Tennessee, and you come out to the West Coast and you're just pretty good. Now, pretty good is pretty good, but it is not the same thing. I had 13 guys on the bench my freshman year who all played 10 years or more in the major leagues, and I was not one of them. So when I came out, I didn't play a lot.
Did you come out specifically to play baseball, or did you come out I think I'll try go out for the baseball team as well?
Right. It was both. I came out, I talked to Coach Adams. I was going to go to Miami, but because my sister was, that's a whole great long story. The year that my sister won the national championship was 1978. I was a senior in high school. We had won the state championship the year before. And during our spring break, the state champs from Pennsylvania were going to be stopping by on their way down to Florida because, you know, they're practicing in the snow all spring. And they were going to play us on their way for a spring trip to Florida. And I thought it was really important because I'm a high school kid and whatever. Meanwhile, my sister they keep advancing. My whole family went out to the West Coast and is following all the games. And that year was the first year that women's basketball is going to be hosted at a major spot. You know, at that time, the basketball powers were Immaculata, Delta State, Louisiana Tech, those types of teams. And now UCLA was going to be hosting the national championship, but they kept winning. So here they were going to be hosting the Final Four in Pauley Pavilion. And it's before internet and all that stuff. I befriended our local NBC sportscaster, Rudy Kalis, at Channel 4 in Nashville. I'm trying to get scores every day off of the AP UPI wire. And so we had this fun thing going back and forth because, of course, my sister Diane was all world in high school. She scored like 4,000 points in high school, was all state for 4 years. And so Rudy was excited because he had this scoop of a story that Diane Frierson was on her way to win a national championship after being all world in Tennessee. And so the Saturday, they won on the Thursday night, which meant that they were going to be in the championship against Maryland at Pauley Pavilion. My family's all excited. I'm at home in Nashville all by myself. And I show up on the Saturday morning with, met Mike Thornton. He and I were always the first ones to the ball field. And this is early in the morning. We always came way early and stretched and clowned around. And as we're sitting there stretching and talking and laughing, all of a sudden, Mike goes, "Hey, did you feel that?" I went, "Feel what?" He goes, "I think that was a raindrop." I went, "Hold it. Let's say so." "Oh, yeah." And then the skies opened up. Nobody else even showed up to the field. And I'm sitting there all day without internet, or live TV, because there's just the four channels, basically, waiting and waiting and waiting to find out what happened. And so when I was trying to decide, I honestly was going to go to Miami and play for Ron Fraser down there. But when I had a chance, and after talking to Coach Adams, Gary Adams, one of the greatest people on the planet, I got to say, Hall of Fame college coach at UCLA. When he said, yeah, come on out. We'd love to have you. I just decided, you know what? I don't ever have to miss another one of her games ever. And we're really tight family. And mm-hmm. so, and I never did. And it was, you know, it was just a thrill for me to be there. And it's kind of fun because my four sisters and I, we're like quintuplets. I got a little brother 10 years behind, but we were all born in 28 months. So my sister Susan, 2 years older, Debbie and Di, a year older. I have a twin sister, Julie. And it was funny because Di and I were at UCLA and we'd always be together on campus. I can't tell you how many times we were asked, are you twins? And we would go, yeah. Well, how come she's a junior and you're a freshman? Well, because her birthday's in September and mine's in November. I don't, you know. So anyway, so that's what got me to UCLA. Mm-hmm. And it was an interesting, you know, you had to be on, you had to have classes from 8 to noon, then you're on the ball field from 1 to 7, then I'm rehearsing shows from 7:30 to 11, then wow. Get up and do it all over again. But those, you know, when it's great to be young and a giant, it's okay. And I was there at UCLA in the theater department with the Tim Robbinses of the world and all, you know, so it was a really great group of people, both on the ball field and up at the theater department. I'm still in good touch with Tim O'Leary, who was player of the year my freshman year at UCLA, and of course was a high draft pick by the Mets and played a number of years. Was comeback player of the year of the Gibson home run for the Dodgers. And he also went to Santa Monica High, where I ended up coaching. And so we haven't even talked about this. I just found out yesterday the Santa Monica Playhouse would like me to do the show again there in February. And way, way back when I was developing it, which interestingly enough, the first ever version of it was at the Sabre National Convention in Washington, D.C., or what was it, Crystal City, across the river, in 1987. I can't believe it. Tim was a part of like that second performance of just, you know, trying to develop the show and raise money for the high school baseball team and all of that. And he's always been a great support, as have been, you know, the entire UCLA baseball fraternity. I make the jokes about don't get me started on the wild card, but I really am thrilled for Torrey Lovello and the Arizona Diamondbacks. There couldn't be a more wonderful human being in the game of baseball, certainly running a baseball team, with the possible exception of Dave Roberts, who's also a UCLA guy. So it's just nice to see a couple of Bruins, and I know that Coach Adams is somewhere in the stands or in the clubhouse just smiling and beaming that his two guys are out there at the pinnacle of the game. That's pretty mm-hmm. cool.
Well, I believe I read somewhere that, I don't even know where to start. I want to talk about acting aside from Maddie, but what happened after UCLA? I mean, leaving aside the airplane flight mm-hmm. and pitching in a pinch, what were you doing before that?
Well, and it's kind of, I don't even think we've even mentioned on the podcast yet that, you know, the whole thing, the show that I created, this Maddie, An Evening with Christy Mathewson.
Right.
My dad is an educator. He's about to turn 90 and is in great shape. So my mom just turned 90. She's doing awesome. You talk about phenomenal human beings. They are the tops. But he still to this day, you know, he still drives and all that. He'll find, there's fewer and fewer of them on the planet, but he'll find old used bookstores and he can spend hours in there just going
on the same way. Sure.
Books and reading and doing and all that and the smell of the store and everything else. Mm-hmm. Well, he came across if my, you know, my memory is probably a little bit embellished and, you know, and fuzzy, but my memory, he was out visiting and was doing a in-service workshop down at UC Irvine or whatever. He used to schedule, he taught teachers how to teach. So he would schedule his seminars and different things around our schedules. So he would come out to watch a baseball game or to catch a basketball game or to go into Indiana and see my other sisters play. You know, that's the kind of family that we are. And we still to this day, it's like, well, why wouldn't I drive to Phoenix to see my niece play volleyball? You know, and it's like, really? It's like, well, yeah, why wouldn't you? But anyway, he came across an old Boy Scout edition of Christy Mathewson's Pitching in a Pinch, which, you know, he and Jack Wheeler put together in 1912, just putting together some of the old newspaper columns that, that Wheeler did for him, transcribed. And here I was, it's 1984. I can't believe it's been so long. It's just crazy. I mean, the fact that I've pretty much been with this whole Christy Mathewson thing almost as long as he lived, which is sad, right? But I became an international volleyball referee, and I'm only 24 years old, and I got asked to call lines and referee at the Olympics in 84. Mm-hmm. And because I'm young and dumb, I said, I'm not going to deal with traffic. I'm not going to drive to Long Beach for volleyball, and I already know all the Russians and the Italians and the Brazilians and everything. I mean, so I've already exchanged the gifts and done stuff at the forum. I don't need to do that. I'm going to go to family reunion, which we do every year on a beach in Florida. And as I'm going out the door, I had the book on my shelf for a couple of years, but it's like, oh, you know what? I need something to read on the plane. And I literally just stepped back in and grabbed the first thing off the shelf, and that's what it was.
Wow.
And when I was, I can still remember the story that just made me literally laugh out loud before that was a thing. And it was a story about Silke Laughlin, old umpire who eventually, you know, became an opera singer and everything else. But there was a line in there saying that the players were afraid to slide into home plate when Silke was working behind the plate for fear that they would cut themselves on the crease in his trousers. And I just thought that was great. And there's dialogue in there with Hannes Wagner and different things and these stories. And I'm like, and the whole Charlie Faust thing. And I thought to myself, self? You can do something with this. You're the same size as this guy. You weigh the same amount. You're right-handed. You kind of, you know.
You pitched in college.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's like, and this fadeaway is just this screwball thing, and you know how to throw that even if you can't. And, you know, it's like, you know what? I could adapt this book and do something with it. And at that time, there really were not, you know, shortly thereafter, there became this influx of just, you know, so many of these one person plays that really were, I found it very hard to ever find one that was any good or entertaining because they were kind of
May I interject? Had you seen Hal Holbrook's show at that point?
And that was the thing. As I said, I could do something like Hal Holbrook, except, you know, I kind of like the, at the time, the only things that were done, James Whitmore was always doing, it was also doing his Harry Truman and Will Rogers. Mm-hmm. And the Harry Truman thing, he, you know, had characters walking in and out and da 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 da. And the Mark Twain thing was just standing and talking and telling the stories and letting the words do the thing. And I thought, you know, I could probably combine those two things in some way and just
so when Whitmore did Truman, did he play the other characters as well?
Yeah, he sort of, you know, to me it was like they're walking in and he's like, what about that MacArthur? And I think somewhere on the internet there's probably a tape of it. You know, they videotaped it and released it in the theaters, I think, in 1968 so that he could get a Best Actor nomination, even though it wasn't a movie. Uh-huh. But it got classified as that, and he mm-hmm. did get a nomination. But anyway, so I was doing that. I'm telling my dad, hey, this book that you got, I think, you know, I could do something with it. And he's like, well, who is it? Christy Mathews? Oh, yeah. Well, where's he from? I don't know. Factoryville, Pennsylvania? Well, where's that? I don't know. Well, let's go down to the AAA. Remember when we did that? Let's go to the AAA and get a map. And see where it is. And so here we are in Pompano Beach, Florida. We go to the AAA. We get the map. And he goes, oh, it's outside of Scranton. It's right there next to Honesdale. Walter B's in Honesdale. Why don't we, when we get back to Nashville, why don't you take the old beat up Colt and drive up there and see if anybody's still alive? Now, Walter B was Walter Barb, who was the editor-in-chief of Highlights for Children. Mm-hmm. And was my dad's advisor when my dad got the first PhD ever at Kent State. So Walter Barb has always a family friend. Just, again, one of the you're lucky to have people like this walk into your life. And so sure enough, I drove up there and I stopped, you know, stayed with Walter. But the thing was I literally thought I was going to do this book. And my first stop was in Lewisburg at Bucknell because I, you know, that was on the way to Factoryville. And it's, you know, the sun is going down. And I see this giant gate out in the middle of a field. And I go, what is that? And it has 1927 on the top. And I said, well, he died in 1925. I wonder where. So I pull the car over in the grass next to the chapel and I walk up. And I go over on the right side, and there's this big plaque, and it's got his image, and it's like Christy Mathewson, New York Giants, da da da, and it just lists all the baseball stuff. And I go, mm-hmm. Wow, that's cool. That's kind of neat that they did this here on the camp. And then going over on the other side, the plaque on the left side is Christopher Mathewson, athlete, soldier, scholar, member of the Glee Club, president of his class historian, member of two literary societies, and all of this academic stuff. And you're like, no way. No, he's a baseball. No way. You know, and so that made me start to go, aha. And I walked up to the library because now I'm on fire because this is kind of exciting. I found something, right? And, of course, later to find out that Christy Mathewson Memorial Gate that every team in Big League Baseball, both American and National League, donated funds to create a memorial on the Bucknell campus for Christy Mathewson. Hmm. Never happened before. Hmm. Has not happened since. Mm-hmm. The entire American and all of organized baseball did it. It's like, well, that, you know, when I found that out, this, well, okay, so this guy's a little more special than I thought. And I get up into the library and I see that archives are downstairs, and I walk downstairs and it says hours on, you know, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. and it's like 9 o'clock at night, but there's a light on inside there. And so I knock on the door, and I can still remember, she's not with us anymore, but just the sweetest lady, Doris Deisinger, who was the historian there at Bucknell at the time, the librarian. And I go, hey, I'm an actor from Los Angeles. I'm going to put together a one-man show about Christy Mathewson. You know, and I can still see her face. She did this big smile and exhale, and she went, oh, Christy. She goes, no one's been here for ages looking at the Christy Mathewson stuff. Would you like me to get it? I said, well, no, your sign says, you know, you closed at 4. I'll come back at 9 o'clock in the morning. She says, I'll have everything ready for you. And then I was wandering around, you know, Lewisburg. I still didn't know where I was going to stay. And there's a huge cemetery there, and I'm kind of walking through the cemetery, and the moon is out, and I'm just like, well, hold it, what direction do I go? And I stop, and then I turn, and no way, there is the Mathewson grave. I'm standing on it, and wasn't even looking for it, didn't know he was buried there. None of it. I mean, all of this was just like, I was an actor from Los Angeles just learning stuff. And stayed, I can still remember, it was the Lewis Burger Hotel, you know, because it hadn't been restored into what it is you know, today. It's the Lewisburg Hotel, just like it was in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. But I went in and $14 for a room, literally had the light bulb hanging from the wire from the ceiling. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking to the guy at the counter because, again, you know, it was off. People weren't on campus. It was the town was quiet. And I said, hey, I'm here. I'm doing this thing. And he goes, hey, Bob, isn't the Mathewson house right across the street here? And I'm like, what? And he goes, yeah, 129 across. I think actually, though, it's his wife's house, or it's like, it's the Stoughton house. And I had thought that it was Stoughton, right? Jane mm-hmm. Stoughton, Matthew, you know, his wife. So that was information piece number one. Now I know how to pronounce the name. He says, yeah, I think it's a gynecologist's office. I'm like, what? And so I walk across, and sure enough, 129, you know, it had whatever it was, gynecologist's office. And so you could walk in the front door, and there's this ornate, you know, solid wood banister with a staircase going up. And to the left, where it would have been, I guess, the parlor, you know, was a locked door. And that's now that was an office and what have you. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. And you know, again, it's midnight and I'm trying to just see, you know, it's dark. I can't even see in there. But I go all the way up to the attic and there's like an old tub there, you know, with no plumbing, you know, like the old days that they would have just put hot water in. Mm-hmm. And I'm going, I wonder if that was like her parents' tub. That's just great. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. The next day, get looking at all the stuff in the Bucknell, you know, trunk of stuff, and finding Pitcher Pollock and Catcher Craig. And hold it, there's more books? And then, oh, here's a clipping from the New York Times. Baseball play, blah. You know, the girl in the pennant, right? Christy Mathewson and Rita Johnson-Young, a thunderous ovation tonight. But Mathewson, in his humility, was not there and, you know, and didn't come out for a curtain call. I'm thinking, no way. Wrote a Broadway play? No way. Okay, so, and of course, I would later find out he wasn't there because he was doing the world tour with the White Sox and the Giants. He was in California when the show opened on Broadway. But it was still another year before I got into New York and into the archives at the Lincoln Center, because I don't know if people know this, but it's a great research opportunity if you're into theater. They have every single stage manager's book from every production that was ever on Broadway. Going back into the 1800s. They've got Edwin Booth's, you know, prompt book with notes from the director, you know. And so I asked them to pull Girl in the Pennant. And they said, well, gosh, nobody has ever requested that. And we are just, and this is, you know, this is in the early to mid 80s. We're trying to figure out how we can, you know, I don't even think they use the word digitized, but to make a permanent electronic copy of everything. So whenever it gets asked, we ask if, you know, if maybe you would donate the $300 or whatever it would take to do that. If you can't do that, that's fine. You can still look at it. I said, well, hey, I'll do that. Sure. So it's not only the stage manager's book, but it's all reviews and all production photos from those productions. And so you can go down and request. It's probably a little bit different now where you got to wear gloves and everything else, just like at the Hall of Fame. But I'm looking at this and I'm looking at these pictures of this set and this play. And of course, it was a very short run because, you know, it wasn't designed to go forever and it was just kind of light fluff. But here are 10 reviews. It's not just the New York Times. It's, you know, because there were all the, were there 8, 15, how many newspapers were there at the time in New York City? And there was morning and evening editions. And it was hilarious. All of the critics came on the same night. And it was right down the middle. 5 of them were, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. And Christy Mathewson, so modest, he didn't even come out and take a bow. And the others, this is the most horrible piece of dreck that ever hit a Broadway stage. And Mathewson had the good sense not to come out because he would have been hit with rotten fruit, right? So, and to me, that was just, again, things that you would never normally find or know. You would just have the New York Times review and think that this was an awesome play. But then now I've got the actual book, and I can read the play. And of course, it's very dated and, you know, not politically correct at all. Right. And Matthew, you could tell that Mathewson's basic job there was to come up with things like Hans Hagner and Ty Robb, you know, right. as character names and different things. And maybe a little bit of baseball jargon, but so it was fun with all of that. Then to find Christy Jr.'s baby book. And I could say Jane Mathewson had made a notation, which anyone who's a parent can appreciate this. Christy Jr. is 4 years old, and she just writes down a quote Right. And you just go, no kid talks like this. Of course, that's why she wrote this down. I needn't say thank you unless company is present. As a four-year-old. So all of these things that humanize the man, mm-hmm. And then letters, you know, then shortly thereafter met his niece, Henry Mathewson's daughter, Grace, who had letters from her dad to Christy when Henry had tuberculosis and was dying. He was off in Arizona, you know, trying, you know, Christy, can you give me a loan? I think if I can just get this ranch out here, the dry weather might heal me. And his wife, Marie, was also had TB. Very sad story there. You know, Henry Mathewson, his wife, died at 31 of tuberculosis, and they had four young daughters. And then the daughters got split up between the two families. So Grace and her other sister never saw the other two sisters ever again. And all of them, except for Grace, died of infant tuberculosis. And Grace lived to be in her 90s and really became like another grandmother to me. She's just a magnificent mm-hmm. lady. And what a thrill for me years later to do the show at the Hall of Fame and for them to invite Grace. And when we rolled up, they literally do everything right at the Hall of Fame. There are mm-hmm. some fantastic people that work there. Literally rolled out the red carpet for Grace Mathewson mm-hmm. Van Langen. And that was so cool. And she's just beaming because she, you know, her husband called her Christy because she would show her teeth and go, this is all Uncle Christy. You know, he said it wasn't as I was told, you know, he was all about my teeth to make sure if you have good teeth, you know, you have good health. And if I ever went to college, he took care of my, you know, the admissions to Syracuse later on. And so that just to find out those kind of things. And, you know, but anyway, there was so much. I mean, I could go for hours about that first trip because I hadn't even met the wonderful Betty Cook yet, who she just passed away this summer. And I always, you know, I even until she passed, I was calling her my 93-year-old girlfriend.
And who is Betty Cook?
Betty Cook became Jane Mathewson's sort of a adopted goddaughter. Mm-hmm. So when Betty lived right on the corner there on Market Street, just kind of across the block from the Stoughton house, the Mathewson house. And when Christy Jr. was killed in a gas explosion in Texas at the age of 45, just like Dad, Jane was not doing very well at all. And she decided to come back to Lewisburg from Saranac Lake because, you know, now she's on her own. And she had family still in Lewisburg. And Betty, who was this gorgeous teenager, she was a young Elizabeth Taylor. So just imagine that. And that's not hyperbole. She's mm-hmm. gorgeous, right? And she was a baseball fan and just wanted to meet Jane Mathewson. And so after she had been back a few days, she just went over one afternoon and knocked on the door, and Jane opened the door and she went in and just could tell that things were not right. That Jane was sort of in a state. There's dishes stacked up, stuff everywhere. She was kind of in a state of, you know, without knowing how to clinically diagnose, probably was in a state of depression at the time and just think. And so here's Betty, as she relayed the story to me, just talking for like the next 4 hours. And she's doing the dishes while she's talking and she's picking up stuff while she's talking. And it's like, well, what are you doing for dinner? Well, you should come have dinner. My mom's a great cook. You know, come on over. And every night for the rest of her life, Jane Mathewson had dinner with the cooks. Hmm. And so one day, the Golden Pass comes in the mail. And she goes, what? You can go to any baseball game that you want? And says, oh, yes, dear, but I don't do any of that. I don't need to do any of that. And then a couple of months later, here comes the invite to the Hall of Fame inductions. Do you ever go? Oh, no, dear, let me show you something. And Betty's still in her stuff when she passed away. She had a Cooperstown, it might have been Oneonta, the newspaper, from 1939 when they dedicated the bust statue of Christy Mathewson at the hall. It's still there. It's kind of in its own almost room with the artwork there at the hall. I was just there this summer. Mm-hmm. And the headline, she goes, I'm too embarrassed to go back. It's a picture of Jane Mathewson with the statue, and the headline is, Mrs. Mathewson Unveils Bust. And she just was just horrified by that and so embarrassed that she could never show her face in Cooperstown again. Well, this is years later now, and Betty says, well, would you think of going? It's like, oh, dear, I don't drive anymore. Well, I'll drive. You want to go? So, yeah, I'll drive. And so then for the next, 20 years, Betty would drive Jane. And, of course, Jane had no idea that she was so revered years later, treated like an absolute queen. And the stories that Betty had, she just needed to have a tape recorder rolling on her for a couple of days of the Hall of Fame inductions and all the stories about the different people. I won't tell you who she said was the biggest pig of all the Hall of Famers, but I will tell you, she said the grandest gentleman ever that was ever inducted in the Hall of Fame was Stan Musial. Just an absolute wonderful man and gentleman and a terrific dancer. So there you go.
Well, I met Musial once 40 some years ago, and he could not have been more gracious. So I am not surprised. I am going to ask you to indulge me with a very quick detour, because I'm afraid if I don't ask now,
I'll just keep talking
later. No, I'll forget later. Before was awed by the list of your voice work credits. And I was hoping maybe you could favor us with one of your favorite character voices from all the years.
Well, there's a lot, and it's kind of funny because you do so much stuff, you just forget about it.
Right, and how do you go back to it? Maybe you can't. I don't know.
Well, yeah, the very first project I was ever part of was the very first Japanese animation series that was ever broadcast, every day here in the United States. It was a show called Robotech, and there are still just tremendous fans from that. And I was Lynn Kyle in the first season of that, who was like the, just the jerk of all jerks, yeah. And so that was a very fun springboard. Got to meet so many people that I still work with today. It's sort of fun. When we were at this little studio, Intersound, we would all, be given these parts. And so we would work by ourselves, but we knew who everyone was and whatever, just enough to wave. But one of that group of people was Bryan Cranston. And it's fun because I just saw a couple of weeks ago, my buddy Steve Apostolina, who's a terrific playwright and actor, was on the picket line, and he bumped into Bryan. And, he wouldn't know who I am from Diddly Squat today, but it's just kind of fun because they get to talk and talk in Intersound, take a picture. It was, it's been that kind of a fun thing. But as far as like stuff goes, one of the most memorable things, because it sort of kicked me in from being a, guy scraping by to, actually being able to make a living, was I was the voice of Petco Pet Stores for 14 years.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Petco. Where the pets go. but there's so many. I do this silly skunk voice in Eddie Murphy, Dr. Doolittle. I say, you stepped on my snooter shooter or whatever it is. it was an ad-libbed line that Betty Thomas, who directed it, thought it was so funny, and she left in. And then credited me as the skunk. Which, typically, right. The thing is like when you, it's just kind of what we do. You just like, you're doing Frozen and they say, okay, get this guy in the bar. And you go, get her, and you don't know what gets in it. And but there's so many of those things and you just kind of forget about it. One of the most fun things is, and my son, Christy, who's in Berlin right now. He's sort of a international superstar in the gaming world with Riot Games, League of Legends, and Valorant. He's sort of the on-camera color guy. He's sort of the Troy Aikman of, or the, like, John Smoltz, if you're trying to do, like, good color guys in baseball. He does that.
Is it just coincidental that you have done a lot of voiceover for games?
I think so, yeah. And, you know, and my kids have always been into games. Who could know you could make a living at that? But, hey, you know, I've got the three greatest kids on the planet, so I'm very lucky there.
You're saying.
Well, you're right. You know, you really are blessed when that happens because not everybody is so lucky. So anyway, where was I? I was talking about, the thing. So, the movie I Am Legend, I get a text from Christy from Berlin saying, hey, didn't you do the noise for the zombie chick in I Am Legend? And I'm laughing because, you know, now I have to get into a voice thing because it's too long. Like, all my stories are a little too long. I say, yeah. The story of that was, if anybody has seen I Am Legend, there's a point in the middle where Will Smith is in his sort of apartment laboratory. And there's this zombie female laying on the table, you know, that's clearly alive but kind of messed up. And a point comes where it shoots up with this giant open mouth, this horrifying, right? And I can still remember we're over at Warner Brothers, and it was a large group of us, probably 20, and 10 is a lot. The director wanted all of the women to go around the room and as he says, say, I need a noise for this, you know, and they didn't quite log that it was a noise. They're all doing their I'm on fire screams, right? Like the blood curdling screams. And I'm looking at the guy and he's just like, oh gosh, you know, one after another. And then when the last gal went, friend Bridget, who was actually pretty good, 'cause she did a more guttural scream. He's still just like, and then he, you know, said, Tommy, you know, let's move on. And you never talk to the director in these things. You just sit back and wait till it's your turn to do whatever it is they want you to do. And I am watching him. I go, I think, and I said, hey, can I try something? And all the eyes in the room shoot around to me like, Eddie, you idiot, what are you doing? And I can still remember him go, you know, kind of like, yeah, sure, why not? Go ahead. You know, I mean, like, really flip like that. And then I thought, well, I'm going to just do my, like, pterodactyl noise. So the Zay's like, beep, beep, beep. And the thing jumps up and it says, this horrible sound, right? And then, you know, he said, oh, that's awesome. Can you do it lower? You know, all right. And it's actually much louder than that, but I don't want to blow away the listeners. And Christy is saying, they're talking about you on this podcast. And I went, what? And he sends me a link, and it's Jason Bateman and John Krasinski and Will Arnett and another guy who was just opening a show on Broadway. And apparently when they were all, you know, younger actors and out of work, they were, and they're saying, oh yeah, you remember that time we went to I Am Legend and that thing? And then they all started doing the noise. I said, yeah, for like 5 years, every time we met, we would go, and so, yeah, and your mom, we would come in the house, and she said, don't you dare make that noise, and then it was Bateman who goes, you know what, whoever that guy was, that's the star of that movie, and my kid is cracking up, laughing, but the most fun thing about that movie for me is not that, because, you know, it's like, well, that's either going to get in or it's not. It's just kind of fun because they're talking about it on a podcast. My buddy Dave Calgill, who I work with all the time, terrific actor, great voiceover guy, but, you know, just a good guy and a pretty good basketball player. In the opening of that movie, when it's in the dark, it's a radio sports talk show. And it's Dave and myself, you know, talking, well, I don't know, you know, what about Chicago? Well, I mean, Chicago, maybe this, blah, New York, blah, 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 blah. And we're, you know, talking, and of course, the Cubs hadn't won at that point. And so it's just kind of veiled references to little things. And then as that WB logo is coming up, I go, thanks a lot, Dave. And he goes, thanks for nothing, Eddie. And that's how the movie starts, which is really fun. So if you're kicking on Netflix, just watch the first 30 seconds and get a charge out of that. But as far as projects that I've ever worked on. And this is great just for the Saberites because it's the most Saber movie that's ever been made. The only project that I feel that I ever worked on that would not have been the same had I not worked on it was Moneyball. Mm-hmm. It was just one of those things where the director, Bennett Miller, it was only his second movie ever. His first one was Capote, terrific movie if you're into mm-hmm. very strange killers. And he could not get across to the post-production people. He says, look, you know, this is a movie, but it's a documentary. It can't be a documentary. It's like, And so, you know, I was just saying, well, is he ever in his car? I said, yeah, he drives a truck. I said, well, then the radio's on when he's in his truck. So in that opening sequence after they, you know, lose that game, you know, when he's sitting in the stadium by himself, flipping on the radio on and off, when he's in his truck, right. It's kind of a talk show with me being the host going, you know, it's like, it's like we're a farm system for the New York Yankees. And so I went through the whole movie doing all these voiceover things. And then we spent a couple of weeks replacing all the stuff I did with other voices so it wouldn't be mm-hmm. the Eddie Show. And the thing that was fun about that, he really badly wanted real ball players. And he's like, I need people who lived in Oakland, who played in Oakland, who were there in 2000. And I'm just, you know, it's like, seriously, you think you're going to find a Screen Actors Union ball player who lived and played in Oakland in, you know, during the Moneyball year? You're out of your mind. But I was given a list of all these folks, including Al Downing, and my ringtone, I can still remember. So Al comes in and he's just sitting over in a corner because he's just happy to get a paycheck and you know, and just be a part of it. Kennedy, who was the manager of the Boston Red Sox during the Hatterberg years, was there. So anyway, I walk over to Al. I'm trying to be kind of, you know, conspicuous. You know, I grew up watching the Braves, and I got to tell you, I think of you a couple of times a day. He goes, why is that? And I said, well, my ringtone. Okay. And I know that he's done this a million times because the timing was so unbelievably perfect and great. And so, you know, it's the Milo Hamilton call of Henry Aaron, which we were talking about earlier. It's like, there's a drive deep in the left center field. It's gone. There's a new home run champion. But it starts with, here's a pitch by Downing. And he drops his head and goes, does he ever miss? There's a drive. And it was so great, so perfect. And so I kind of felt like Al Downing was, you know, I have this joke with like my family. Whenever you meet somebody famous, even if it's just like, hey, how are you? Nice to meet you. They suddenly, well, it's my close personal friend, Al Downing, you know. So that was really fun for me. That whole process of trying to create, you know, entertainment with, you know, so really the only documentary part of that movie is the win streak toward the end. Mm-hmm. And let me tell right. you, voiceover people never get invited to the premieres. That was a special year in my life. My nephew-in-law, my cousin Bo's daughter, was married to Landon Powell, who was catching for the A's that year. So mm-hmm. I took my kids up there. We saw a ball game once because Christy was in a Rubik's Cube speed cube competition. This is a kid that can look at a Rubik's Cube. He still is in the top 1,000 in the world for solving it one-handed, and like did in 16 seconds or something absurd, because mm-hmm. it's all math, Dad. Right. Okay, great. You know, I can't get my head around that, but okay, I get it. Anyway, we're up there for a competition. We're waiting in a tunnel, and we're waiting for Landon to come out, and this gigantor dude comes out, and he's like, what are you doing? And Christy goes, here, mess it up, and gives him the cube, and he gives it, and it's like, ching, 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 ching. And the guy's, no way. Well, how do you learn to do that? Well, I'm going to a competition. And he was, what, sixth grade, seventh grade? I'm doing a competition at Cal tomorrow, and that's why we're up here, you know, and to see Landon. And he's like, well, I went to Cal. And so now all the players, as they're coming out down the tunnel, they're all messing up the Rubik's Cube and getting it to do it. So they remembered that because I guess, you know, because it was memorable. Then later in the summer, my 9-year-old, we went to Orlando and was part of a team that won a national championship in that 9-year-old age group at the, you know, Wide World of Sports there. Well, it turned out that the A's were playing in Tampa. So we went over to Tampa Bay, and now we're waiting in the tunnel so my kid can show the championship trophy to Landon. And all the guys are coming out. Where's the cube? Right? It's like how, you know, most ball players don't remember stuff like that. Then right. It was that October where the premiere was in Oakland at the old, you know, big ornate theater that they have in downtown, you know, the rest.
Yes,
of
Yes, I saw a press screening.
Right.
At that same theater.
Oh, it's so great. So the whole balcony was just with contest winners. So It's fans up in the balcony. Now, down below, here I am, and I've arranged the Allie had called me and said that the trainer's wife, they didn't have a pass for her. Could I get her a pass? It's like, well, yeah, I think I can. So got the trainer's wife a pass to get in. Meanwhile, the guy who went to Cal stands up in the middle of the theater and goes, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I worked on this movie. Hey, can you introduce us to Brad Pitt? I said, sure. And I said, come on down. Now, I don't know Brad Pitt from Diddley Squat, right? But, you know, so I take him down and I go, Brad. And he's like, huh? And I said, this is, you know, so-and-so. So they play for the A's and they just wanted to meet you. And then I walk away and they for 5 minutes are chatting with Brad Pitt and are just in heaven, right? But the coolest part, and I think the point of this story was that section of the winning streak, which is the only documentary real part in it. The balcony was rocking. I thought that it was going to come crashing down. They're going, let's go, A's! Yeah, it was so cool and cool for the players. But now here's the absolute greatest thing for me. I'm sitting down, you know, they sort of had assigned seating. I didn't, you know. And they're getting ready for the movie to start, and in comes this, you know, very distinguished gentleman. See, now they're playing. It was a Monday night because it was a night off for both teams. But the next night they were playing the Rangers, and they arranged to have the premiere on this night so that Ron Washington could be there because he was managing the Rangers at the time, you know. And, you know, I knew all the stories of what a great guy he was and all that stuff. But anyway, here comes this distinguished gentleman and his wife, and they sit down right next to me. It's Ron Washington. And I don't know if you remember the previous playoff, there had been two plays in the course of just a few minutes, which you only see in, like, you know, little league ball when you're boat racing a team. First of all, you know, you got runners at first and third. You never do you never see the double steal in the major leagues ever, right? Because you're going to throw them out and you're going to throw them out. Well, Ron, I guess, in the playoff game, recognized, well, they probably haven't worked on this since spring training, so he takes off as soon as the throw goes through, he stole home, and they score a run, right? Also in that, you had the runner at second taken off for third, the bunt is laid down, the third baseman fields the ball, throws to first, the guy from second never slows down, he scores from second base on a bunt. And I said, hey, Ron, I got to tell you, because I showed the clips of that to my kids, the 10-year-old team that I'm coaching right now, because that's what we work on all the time. I said, even the big guys do this. And I will never forget. He tapped me on the shoulder with a big smile. And he goes, never forget the little boy. It's what got us here. And I went, oh. And then to see him and see how he is so beloved by the Braves now, and the fact that he works with opposing team players before the game. I mean, there are special people on this planet, and I think Ron Washington is one of them.
Well, as I mentioned in the intro, that was just the first part of my conversation with Eddie Frierson. Sure hope you'll be back next week for part two, and I think you will. If you enjoyed this episode, I highly recommend going back and listening to one or more of our episodes with the delightful Ellen Adair another actor. Ellen first joined us way back on episode 75. Also, episode 129 with her partner in life and podcasting, Eric Gildy. And then again for episode 210 earlier this year with Eric and author, writer Noah Gattel in a roundtable about baseball movies. Ellen and Eric, of course, came to my attention some years ago due to their podcast, Take Me Into the Ballgame, about baseball movies. The last episode was, about 6 months ago, 5 months ago, about the movie 42. They will be back, I have been told, but I'm not sure when. Looking forward to hearing Ellen's and Eric's voices soon on their podcast. I hope it's soon. But speaking of Ellen's voice, she is the lead in a brand new movie called Herd, which has been receiving excellent notices and can be streamed on demand in various places. I believe she said Apple TV Plus and Prime Video, but you know how to search for movies. And it's also playing in a few theaters around the country, maybe more soon. So if you like zombie movies, or I'm not a zombie guy, but if you like zombie movies or you enjoy Ellen's work, which I do, having seen her in a number of television shows, go look for that. Support Ellen and her work. This last week, I read a couple of books on the baseball side. I read Chris Coast's book, The 33-Year-Old Rookie, How I Finally Made It to the Big Leagues After 11 Years in the Minors. Entertaining account. Chris is a good writer and seems like a good guy. I don't do this very often, but if you know anyone who works for the Fargo-Moorhead Redhawks, or if you know Chris, please reach out to me or to them. I would love for Chris to be on this podcast. And so far, my efforts to email and call Chris and the Redhawks has gone to naught. I do hope to get an email back from the Redhawks management or a phone call at some point soon, but it hasn't happened yet. And speaking of well-written books and podcast guests, I also read last week Michael Lewis's new number one bestseller, Going Infinite, about FTX. Remember their nice patches on the umpires' jerseys? Boy, that was exciting. Lewis was, of course, well, maybe not of course, you might remember he was on episode 213 of this show last spring. We talked a little bit about Going Infinite, mostly about Moneyball, but other things as well, including the new book, which he had not written yet. I will say, while I'm not terribly interested in the subject of Going Infinite, and don't skip ahead if you read it, but this book has one of the great endings I've ever read. Good luck to Michael with the book and the inevitable movie or miniseries, etc., etc. He just keeps plugging along. I'm not going to spend any time on a winner of the weekend because this episode is already running so long. Actually, it's not running as long as it would if we hadn't split it into two pieces, but still a long episode. The only Major League Baseball over the weekend consisted of a single ALCS game. Congratulations to the Rangers. Exciting game Sunday night. Lots more exciting baseball in the coming week. And I think a week from now, when we are back with part two of our conversation with Eddie Frierson, we'll have a lot of baseball to talk about as well. Well, not Eddie and I, we've already talked, but you and I. Please check the show page for information about Eddie, information about the 33-year-old rookie, and maybe the zombie movie. As always, thanks to Eddie for joining us. Thanks to Jacob Pomerinke for spreading the word. Thanks to our fantastic producer, J.W. Cox. And most of all, as always, thanks to you for listening. Have a great week.
This has been SaberCast with Rob Dyer, a production of the Society for American Baseball Research. Find even more baseball research, previous episodes of SaberCast, bonus content from this episode, and a list of what Rob's reading at saber.org. Music for SaberCast is provided by the Baseball Project. Situation when I